Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the television shows of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s shape what we watch today? Compared with the glossy, high-def productions of modern times, the shows many of us grew up on today seem almost quaint. But in their time, programs as diverse as Star Trek, I Spy, Big Valley, and Sesame Street helped introduce Americans to new ways of seeing and understanding the changing world. Of course, they also have nostalgic appeal. Mike Trinkline is producer of the series Pioneers of Television, which is running Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA. Channel 13 TV. The episode that aired earlier this week looked at how science fiction captivated early television audiences, to be followed by retrospectives of small screen westerns, crime dramas, and kids programming. Mike, welcome to Think.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So this is actually the second round of programs you've done on classic TV for PBS. How did you decide which genres to focus on this time?
Well, I think we just worked through what we thought would be interesting to the audience and what... You know, one of the challenges we have is just finding genres for which the pioneers are actually around. I mean, there actually is a challenge because, you know, we interview people and a lot of times they'll pass away. I mean, we talked to the last interview with Stephen J. Cannell and Robert Culp and Peter Graves and Fess Parker. And so we're really fortunate to get those interviews, but a lot of the pioneers are passing on. And so it's a challenge to tell the story without having those people on camera.
It's interesting, the process, too, because I guess you would talk to one person, and then that person would sort of provide you access to the next person you needed to speak to.
Yeah, my co-producer, Steve Betcher, is a master at this. He really knows how to get these interviews. It's a challenge. And when we interview one of these celebrities, like a William Shatner or a James Garner or Bill Cosby, Angie Dickinson, what we're doing is we're sitting down with them for 2 or 3 hours and really getting into some details that maybe they haven't gotten into before. And the show does not really get into you know, their personal lives too much. It's mostly about the craft and about the shows and about how they were made and why they were significant and what people were thinking at the time. And that's for the focus of the series.
So next week we can watch the episode that's about westerns, which are not very popular today, but were huge, like from the dawn of TV until the early 70s. Is it true that there were 30 westerns on the air in 1959?
Yeah, there were, and over 100 total over that in that time frame.
Wow.
Yeah.
What sort of vision did they tend to present of America and of its history?
Well, you know, the Western really is kind of a uniquely American art form, and it has appeal around the world. And it's sort of how the rest of the world sees us, and frankly, it's kind of how we see us as sort of independent people going out, you know, wrestling with the land and making our own way, and it just sort of reflects America so well that it was a very, very popular genre. And also contributing to that is the fact that because it was so popular in the movies before television came on, there was a huge infrastructure to make westerns already set up. The sets were built, the stunt writers were ready, and so when television came along, it was a natural fit.
I think what's so remarkable about Westerns, and you really show this in the series, is the fact that they often actually challenged notions of the time they were made about ethnic identities and gender roles and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a profound point that has been forgotten, but you raise a really interesting issue, and that is that in the 1960s, we were going through a lot of social change. The role of women, the role of African Americans, other ethnic groups, all this change was happening in that time frame. And in the show set in modern day in the 1960s, you couldn't really talk about those issues. But in Westerns, you could. So because it was really, wouldn't rile up people who might otherwise get riled up because it was seen as something different. It was in a different time in the past. And so shows like Daniel Boone, for example, Fess Parker made it a point to have African-Americans on his show, and there were very few on television, and to sort of talk about, you know, issues of race and equality in that Old West context. And a guy like Rosie Greer was on that show, an African-American football player turned actor, and, you know, sort of helped people see things a little differently. And that show wasn't alone. They, you know, Gunsmoke did the same thing, Bonanza did the same thing. They were subtly trying to help us understand a different way of thinking.
And then you had Barbara Stanwyck in Big Valley, which was a big deal because she was very much at the heart of that show, and she was a strong woman who wasn't waiting around for some guy to come solve all her problems.
Yeah, it was really the first Western to have a strong woman as the star of the show. And, you know, Barbara Stanwyck's passed on, but Linda Evans talked to us at length about her relationship with Barbara Stanwyck. Linda was, of course, also on that series, The Big Valley, and how, you know, Barbara Stanwyck sort of taught her how to be independent and stand up for herself, and it's kind of a fascinating story. But yeah, it was a very unusual thing in a TV Western for a woman to have that kind of a strong role.
You know, as a kid, I was never, you know, Westerns would come on in the afternoons as reruns, and I was not a big fan, but I could watch Bonanza, and I think it was just a totally different kind of thing. It was really a family story.
You know, it really was a family drama about a father and his three sons. And, you know, it was interesting. We talked to a lot of people about that show, and the series producer, David Dortort, decided early on there were going to be no women on that show, no continuing women characters, and they got killed off constantly.
Yeah, no fiancé was ever going to last.
Yeah, it wasn't going to last, absolutely, and that was designed by the creator of the show. Yeah, I wouldn't see that today. Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman wouldn't do that, for sure.
So as Westerns started to decline in popularity, we saw the rise of the crime drama, and they coexisted for a while, but can you talk about how those shows, did they reframe the good and evil dichotomy that we saw in a lot of Westerns?
Well, I think that's true in many ways. In that, in both cases, you're right, good and evil. And in the crime drama, you know, the good guys get the bad guys and the good guys win out. It may not be true today in television, but it is still largely true. And it was especially true in that time period where you had black hats and white hats. And it was a... You're right. The crime drama was certainly, some people would say, just an extension of the values in the American Western.
When we talk about Westerns, do you think they were always a better reflection of the year they were made than of any imagined past?
That's an interesting question. That's a very good question, because we have, our production company has made films about the Old West, you know, the one on the Oregon Trail and one on the Gold Rush. And you make a really good point that there's a lot of difference between the imagined romantic Western and what really happened in the Old West. You know, when we did our Oregon Trail film, I was surprised to find that, you know, kids walked across the United States. They didn't ride in wagons, and they walked barefoot. You never saw that in a Western. And, in fact, it was kind of funny. We talked to Johnny Crawford, who was in The Rifleman. He was the younger boy in that series. And he made the point that even as a kid, yeah, you know, he was in that show when he was 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. He would say, you know, these guns, these hats, these saddles, they didn't have these in the 1880s. I mean, they were using modern-day stuff, and even then it kind of bugged him. And it may have bugged others, but in general we didn't seem to care about the Westerns in that time period. Nowadays there's much more of a press for authenticity.
Yeah, it's funny. You think about the research that goes into even a show like Mad Men and every detail. Even when you think they didn't have that, you go Google it and you realize that, yes, they did, whatever they're dealing with on that particular episode.
I got a kick out of bringing up Mad Men, that there's a whole website dedicated to how Mad Men uses the wrong fonts in some of the printed material on the desks and things. And yeah, there's this ability now to sort of talk about shows and communicate and sort of correct, et cetera, that maybe wasn't there in the 1960s. That's true.
So was there an effort to make those crime shows more authentic, or were they still sort of romanticized?
Well, they were really unauthentic. You're absolutely right. I mean, we talked to, for example, Mike Connors, who was TV's Mannix, one of the longer-running crime dramas. And he said, look, we had to have a fist fight in every episode. We had to shoot our guns twice in every episode. I mean, you had to have a car chase in every episode. Well, a real private investigator never did any of those things.
Yeah.
But it was really, it was a fantasy. But it's a, you know, the thing about the crime drama is that they're still popular because it's an easy storyline to create. I mean, you have a problem and you have a solution and you have an investigation. That's kind of fun for audiences to follow. So that's part of the reason crime dramas have lasted so long. But I think they really fall into a couple of two categories, really. One are the procedurals, where you follow a crime from beginning to end. And that really began with a show like Dragnet, but we see the echoes of that today in shows like CSI, for example. Mm-hmm. And the other type of crime drama really is more about the sort of personality-driven. Shows like Columbo or The Rockford Files back in the pioneering era. And, of course, we have those kind of, you know, shows today like The Closer, a favorite of mine. That's a personality sort of driven show.
Yeah, it is interesting that a lot of the conventions that were born then that now seem a little over the top still have echoes in what we watch today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the basic principles of what we see really were laid out back in these early days. You know, it took a guy like Jack Webb, the creator of Dragnet, to realize that, you know, in movies they had all these big wide panoramas, and he realized you can't do that on a tiny little TV. You have to go in for the close-up of the person's face to really get that emotion. And Dragnet was built on that, and basically every show since then, up until the modern HD era, has used tons of close-ups to convey their storylines. But someone had to think that up. Someone had to figure that out.
And it also, I guess, had an impact on the kind of acting that one would do. If suddenly your facial expression really counts, the dialogue still matters, but it also it requires a sort of nuance.
Well, you know, it's funny. William Shatner talked about that extensively, among other people. And his point was, when you're on TV for hours and hours and hours and hours, unlike a movie, your real personality ultimately does come through, and you have to be able to either be real or be true, or fake it really well. and there's ways to do that, but I mean it's something that requires a different level of. Well, the other thing about TV is it requires a level of likability. I mean, most of the people that we think of as TV stars are people that we like, and that, you know, isn't easy to fake. I mean, we can instantly tell if we like somebody or if we don't.
Mike Trinkline is my guest. He's a producer of the PBS series Pioneers of Television. It runs Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA Channel 13 Television. The next installment will cover TV Westerns next Tuesday, the 25th. We'd love for you to join the conversation, talk about your TV classic favorites at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is here now, producer of this show. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, what a great conversation. And, of course, we all remember and have our favorite shows from the thrilling days of yesteryear. And it's great to be able to feature this series on the show today because, you know, it's airing on PBS. It's airing on our sister television station. So if you're enjoying the conversation, if you enjoy Think Every Day, if you like what you get from KERA and Public Radio, please call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org. It is the second day of the winter membership campaign, and we'd love to get this thing off to a great start this week so that you know, we can get it over with and get back to everything that you love about KERA, everything that inspires you to call or contribute online today.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Perhaps even better is to go online and do this at kera.org. It's simple to make your contribution in any amount. You can also set up a sustaining membership so that you can set it and forget it, in the words of, was that one of those famous TV ovens that they sold or something? I don't know. Set it and forget it.
The Easy Bake Oven?
I don't know. It's one of those infomercial ovens. Anyway, maybe Mike Trinkline will do his next series on infomercials and we can find that out.
I doubt it.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Anyway, we would love your support. And the dollars that you send to us go straight to programming and the things that support programming. This is a not-for-profit organization. Mm-hmm. We try very hard. You know, money's tight here as it is everywhere. And we try to act responsibly even when it's not. But when we ask you for your money, we promise that you'll be able to listen every single day to how we're spending it. And we hope that you have been pleased with the results in the past. You're listening now, and we think that's worth a contribution.
Yeah, the station's not, we're not planning to go anywhere. But, you know, it has been a challenging couple of years, and we do have hard costs that are associated with bringing you all the national programming. And even, you know, even as I say on the phone sometimes, our little old local show, Think, you know, we have to turn the lights on. We have to repair the mics. I just had to switch headphones because the headphones that I had on
only one ear was
pulling. Aren't working properly. So, you know, that has to be repaired. So that's just the way it goes with, like, your household or any business, anywhere you work or your own personal business. We've got bills that have to be paid, and we turn to you a couple of times a year and ask you to help offset the cost.
And it's extraordinary how many of you are willing to help. We greatly appreciate your contributions. You can add your name to that esteemed list by going online right now to kera.org, or you can call us at 1-888-694-6931. Give us $5,000, give us $5 a month. Whatever works for your budget is greatly appreciated here at the station. Again, kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mike Trinkline. He's producer of the PBS series Pioneers of Television, which runs Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA Channel 13 Television. The next installment will handle TV Westerns. That takes place Tuesday, January 25th. After that, there will be a program about kiddie shows, rather about crime dramas and then kiddie shows. If you'd like to join the conversation, talk about your favorite TV memories, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about Policewoman because for whatever reason, this genre seemed really comfortable in taking risks, and casting Angie Dickinson was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, no woman had ever been the lead in a successful crime drama before, and this was a time when we forget, even the 1970s, there was still a lot of controversy about whether or not women could do a man's work, and you know, it's just sort of hard for us even to imagine today, but it was a big issue back then, and she was really a groundbreaker. She was the first woman to portray that kind of role on television at a time when there really weren't many women in law enforcement or doing a lot of executive jobs. So one thing we learned in that show and a lot of other shows is that young people would watch these shows and then realize they could do something that they maybe didn't think about doing. Tons of young kids watched Lost in Space and then decided to become, you know, aerospace engineers. You know, it happened. And it's kind of cool. I mean, we forget how influential TV can be.
Yeah. And Angie Dickinson, Pepper Anderson, I should say, was good at her job.
She was good at her job, yeah. Although it's kind of funny. I mean, she was... it was very important to her to be authentic in, you know, how she shot the gun and those kind of things. She wanted to be accurately represent what a policewoman would actually do. At the same time, it's clear that the writers put her into very sexy situations whenever they could to take advantage of, you know, Angie Dickinson's, you know, beauty, and they'd put her in showers and they'd put her in, they'd make her a stripper on different, you know, just constantly. You know, and she did it. She was a good worker.
You talk about the influence that the TV has, even when we don't realize it. And I think about a show like I Spy, which was Robert Culp and Bill Cosby. That was a show that essentially made a statement about racial equality by saying nothing at all.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Culp talked to us about this, and so did Bill Cosby in a rare interview. And they made the point that up until that time, really, you had never seen an African-American man and a white man as equals in any performing arts of any kind, really. There were plenty of African-Americans on television or in movies, but they were always in subservient roles. And here you had them portrayed as equals. And the idea was that, you know, they did it very much on purpose to try to help the rest of the country see the possibilities during the civil rights era. I mean, this show came out right after, you know, the marches on Selma. There was a lot of racial stress. And there was an overt attempt to try to show how the world could be in that program. And Bill Cosby tells us he ultimately thinks he wasn't successful because there was lots of racial strife after that, although I think he was very, very influential.
Yeah, and there's only so much you can expect one television program to do.
Well, that's certainly true. And you know, one show by itself isn't going to change the culture, but over and over again, you saw lots of different shows. I mean, the same thing happened on Mannix, where they cast an African-American woman in a role on that show, and Mission Impossible cast an African-American on that show. And the idea was, again, overtly to try to change how we think about things. And I think altogether, these shows really did have an effect, because you got to remember, at that time, there were only three shows on any given night, and so the shows had huge audiences, and people watched them.
It's interesting when you think about Bill Cosby's efforts, because then you have him not quite 20 years later starting The Cosby Show, and that's another show where you have this successful, happy, intact African-American family. Not only did they not really address the fact that that existed, they were comfortable with being African-American, but they didn't spend all their time thinking about dealing with racism. They just lived their lives.
Well, you know, it's funny, if you want to interview Bill Cosby, he insists that you talk to all his consultants.
Really?
And the people who work with him. And we did. There were consultants on that show and on the other shows. And Mr. Cosby himself actually got his PhD in education. I mean, he was really interested in how television could be a force for good. And he got his PhD, and I read it, all 184 pages, and all he's talking about is how television can influence people. And even before the Cosby Show, he did, of course, Fat Albert, which was very overtly attempting to portray positive values, not just to African-American youth, but to all youth of all flavor. And it was a very successful show in that regard.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who writes, I was teased unmercifully for my love of Star Trek. I suppose I brought it on, given that I taped cassette audio each episode and played them over and over. My family often rolled their eyes. Can you speak to some of the cultural comments that Star Trek pioneered? Or cultural moments, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by cultural moments, but I mean certainly the show was a... Well, what's interesting about it is that at the time, the show was not that popular, and it only lasted 3 years, and it barely lasted 3 years. It really didn't gain popularity until later, and arguably that was because the rating systems of that earlier period were not very good. But I think what your emailer is referring to is just the show was really very different from anything else. I mean, there was science fiction before Star Trek, but it was always about monsters that were going to take over and, you know, terrible things that the future was going to bring. But Star Trek said, hey, you know, the future's going to be cool. The future's going to be neat, and it's going to be a positive thing. And that's what really made it very different.
And initially, the network thought that Mr. Spock was a really bad idea?
Yeah, they didn't. He looked too devilish, they thought. It's sort of funny. I mean, it's always, and I know my audience is in the South to some degree, and it was always about, well, we're worried about the South. You know, for some reason there, that was always the concern by the networks that
we're smart down here.
Exactly. There you go. And of course, Mr. Spock was not controversial at all, and was the big breakout character in Star Trek, and really made Leonard Nimoy's career. Of course,
was it a big deal in the episode where William Shatner and Nichelle Nichols kissed?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about that extensively in the episode because it was a little different than people think. I mean, it was the first time, you know, there was an interracial kiss on American television, and the network, after they shot it, decided they didn't want to put it on the air, and they wanted the different scene shot differently, and William Shatner sort of personally changed that to make it the way he wanted, which was with the kiss, although his point always was it wasn't so much because, you know, he didn't have any really agenda. He just figured his character, Captain Kirk, would never resist a pretty woman. So it was the first of its kind, absolutely.
And I think maybe the most fascinating bit of trivia from that is that Martin Luther King was a Trekkie.
Well, yeah, I don't think they called them Trekkies back then, although, you know, I think maybe, I don't know, it's a good question, but what's what we say in the episode? But yes, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, tells the story of how she was going to quit the show, because what would happen is that William Shatner is a very strong actor, a very strong character. When his script would come in with lots of other people having lines, including Nichelle Nichols, he'd rewrite it or have it rewritten to focus on his character. And she just got really tired of going, you know, getting a script and then having everything rewritten. So all she had to say was, you know, hailing frequencies open. And so she was going to quit. And Martin Luther King personally was a big fan of the show and said, you have to stay on the show because, you know, African-Americans need a role model to look up to. And you're the only African-American woman in an executive position on television. You have to stay there. Even if you're not saying much, just your presence is an important role model.
You spoke earlier a little bit about Fat Albert, and the episode that airs, I think it's February 8th, is about local kids' TV. We forget this now, but before PBS Kids, before Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel, local stations very often made their own kids' programming.
Yeah, it's something we forget, but it was a really special time in American television where the idea in early television was that all TV stations would make their own shows, especially local kids' shows. And so every small town and every big town had their pirate or their clown or their spaceman or their cowboy, and he would introduce some commercials, and he would do funny bits, or she, many times she. And these shows were wildly popular, and part of the reason they were so popular is that you could then go down to your station, you know, in your hometown and get on the show and be in the audience and see your favorite big celebrity up close and personal. And so it was really a different way of understanding television. There was a connection to the audience that we don't have today, unfortunately. And some of these shows, like Bozo or Romper Room, were sort of syndicated. Not syndicated. They were franchised ideas. So each town had their own Bozo, their own Romper Room lady, but she was local, even though the idea had come from a national source. But many of the shows were just locally produced. Some, you know, the guy in the sales department would say, they'd tell him, I mean, over and over I heard the story. Some salesman, they'd say, hey, you're the clown. You're going to be on our clown show. And he'd go, what? In the next 40 years, he's the clown.
And one famous clown who got a start that way was, well, not his absolute start, but his first claim to fame, Willard Scott, was a Bozo the Clown in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, he was Bozo the Clown, and he'll tell us a story in the episode about how it was hard on him. I mean, you know, it was tough. Kids would, one thing he'd tell us, we didn't put it in the episode, but I'll tell your audience. I mean, kids would get so excited, they'd sit on Bozo's lap and they would pee. and they would just, one kid tried to beat him up. I mean, it was you never knew what was going to happen on these shows, and it was hard on him. And he only did it for 3 years, but what he did then was he would do these personal appearances as Bozo, and then those were so popular when the Bozo show ended in that market, then he started doing these personal appearances. It was for McDonald's, and McDonald's said, "Well, we got to keep this going." So he said, "Well, we'll make our own clown," and he invented Ronald McDonald. Willard Scott personally created Ronald McDonald.
And it's pretty amazing because if you think about it, Ronald McDonald sort of looks like Bozo with the red nose and the flaming red hair sticking out.
Well, that's exactly right, and there've been a lawsuit or two about that, but it's all settled now.
And Bozo was also a huge merchandising thing, which is something today we very much associate with kids programming, but wasn't always the case.
Yeah, all these local shows, not just the Bozos, they all made their money by pitching products on the air. They would play with a toy, and then they would say, "Hey, boys and girls, if you want this toy, you can get it down at Fred's Toy Shop down on Main Street," and that's how they made their money. And nowadays, we think of protecting kids from that kind of hard sell. And in fact, at that time, it was widespread, except one woman. And it's a pretty fascinating story, and we talk about it in the episode. One woman, basically, by herself, Peggy Charon in Massachusetts, said, "This is ridiculous. We shouldn't be exploiting kids this way." She got a bunch of her friends together in her living room on the kitchen table, and they created a group. And that group, within a year, had gone to the Congress and got the law changed so that you cannot any longer have hosts of kids shows selling products, and that dramatically changed the face of kids TV. I mean, because their income stream was gone, and so a lot of the shows went off the air as a result of one woman who didn't want kids to be over-advertised to.
Mike Trinkline is my guest. He's producer of Pioneers of Television, a series running Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA Channel 13 Television. We'll resume our conversation with Mike in a couple of minutes, and if you'd like to share a favorite television memory, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Before you do that, though, we would ask that you call an even more important number, and that's the number to join not just the show, but the entire station, the entire team that makes public radio possible. Please call 1-888-694-6931 and say you'll give a few dollars to your favorite radio station, or go online and do it at kera.org. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And hello to Karen Ford in Cedar Hill. Thank you so much. Also to David Walsh and Todd Hedrick in Dallas, Jill Hobbs in Hawkins, and Rebecca and Kevin Bailey in Dallas. They've all done their part for this, your and their public radio station in North Texas.
Thank you, Bernard Redler in Dallas and Nellie Anderson in Sachse, Patrick Greer in Grand Prairie, and Craig Foster in Denton. All those contributions add up, makes a big difference to us, and allows us to continue bringing you the shows you love, whether it's Think, whether it's All Things Considered, or Morning Edition, or Car Talk on the weekends, whatever it is that you like to hear. Many people love to listen to anything you ever wanted to know with Jeff Whittington. Your dollars directly affect our ability to make those programs and to broadcast those programs to you every day.
You turn to KERA and you turn to public radio to make sense of what's going on in the world, to get the information that you need to be that better citizen. And, you know, we know, you know, everybody knows that times are tough. And as happens when the political winds blow this way and that, you know, CPB funding gets put on the list for possible chopping block status.
As wind blowing goes, the forecast is not the best this year that it's been.
No, it's just the way it is. You know, I mean, it happens. It's a political thing. And you should know that KERA receives about 10% of our budget from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is funded by the United States Treasury, to put it really bluntly. But about 58% of our funding comes directly from you. So it's not that huge of a percentage. However, What would happen in your household if you lost 10% of your funding? Again, it's not being voted on today. It's not happening right now, but it is on the table for discussion. And, you know, we understand that times are tough for everybody. But if you've considered supporting the station, if you would like to help out, maybe that's a reason to make that call, to go ahead and make that call to 888-694-6931, or to go ahead and make that online contribution at whatever level is right for you. At KERA.org. We hear every day on the news that the economy is finally starting to turn around. People are hiring, and things are starting to look up in 2011. So, you know, maybe that's happening a little bit for you, and you can step up and help your public radio station help you stay a well-informed citizen in 2011.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. My favorite way to make a contribution is online at KERA.org. I was thinking about this the other day, Jeff. You know, the average gift is something between $100 and $120. Lots of people give more. Many people give less according to their budgets. But I was thinking about the fact that, you know, I like to, when I can, take my kids to theater events and things, and we have a great time. And it's I always feel like it's worth the expense because it's great to expose them to this. But that's one night. And you can spend in one night on entertainment what you might spend in a whole year supporting KERA. I'm not saying pick one or the other, but I'm saying that it's certainly worth an investment in something that gives you maybe that same 2 hours every single day throughout the year.
There are places where you can go out to dinner, Chris, and spend $300 on dinner.
I've heard of those places, but I've heard tell of those
places
myself.
You know, so we're really talking about something that's incredibly affordable for many of you, because you know we know a little bit about you. We don't necessarily know your names unless you've called and supported or
we know some
gone
of your
online.
Names.
Yes, we do gone online and supported the station in the past. But if you're someone who has not become a member of the station or supported the station, we don't really know your name, but we kind of know. You know, what you're like, because this whole demographic thing, we kind of have an idea of who listens to public radio and who supports it. So we know that you can probably make an affordable contribution to the station, and we would encourage you to do it now because you are listening and you are enjoying the program, and you should support it. And we actually are talking to you. So please don't wait. Please call 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org.
You are KERA. Think about it that way because you make it possible. Again, you can go online to make your contribution by credit or debit card, or you can set up a sustaining membership there. You can also give us a call at 1-888-694-6931. We really appreciate your contribution, and we'll be back with Mike Trinkline in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is producer Mike Trinkline. He made the PBS series Pioneers of Television, which runs Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Doug, who writes, "As kids in the late 60s and early 70s during summer break, we would come in for lunch and then watch Sea Hunt, Ripcord, and Whirlybird, where all crimes and conflicts were solved underwater, falling from a plane or from a helicopter." Did you look at those adventure shows as you were deciding on the genres you wanted to do?
Well, yeah. I mean, those were shows aimed a bit more at kids, and it's kind of a fun genre to think about. We didn't look into Sea Hunt, although that's a show I enjoyed too.
You know, it's interesting about TV from when we were kids. There were a few kids' shows, but it seems as if children spent a lot more time in prime time watching things that they were expected to be watching with their parents, as opposed to one channel just for kids that served up things that they liked and then something more adult for their parents.
Well, it's true. I mean, there was this pressure made on filmmakers and television producers, I should say, to make shows that really did appeal to the wide range. So a show like Lost in Space had its very silly elements, but there were also always elements in there for teenagers and even for adults. And it all depended on the time slot. The 7 o'clock time slot was supposed to have some sort of kid-friendly content, whereas later time slots might be more adult, in the right quotation marks. So, yeah, it is interesting how, You know, we all watch the same shows. And, you know, I have a 14-year-old son, and there's just a lot of TV I still don't want to watch with him. And it's kind of sad because I wish we could go back to a time when TV was a bit more family-friendly.
Yeah, the way it happens in our house is that if we're going to watch with our kids, we end up always watching their shows, unless it's a documentary or something, because we don't feel comfortable introducing them to the things that we like to watch.
Yeah, it is true. I don't even watch Desperate Housewives with my son. And, you know, there was concern even back then that, oh, certain shows were too violent. The Untouchables is an example of a show we talk about that has tremendous amounts of violence. But what's interesting, if you really watch those episodes, as we've done, is that while there's a lot of gunfire and a lot of, you know, car crashes and such, it's a little different than what we think of as violence today. There isn't the gore that you see. Like, I watched a show last night called V, a fine show, but really just full of torture and gore and blood and guts. And, you know, you see that on CSI all the time. And, you know, even the violence that was decried back then didn't compare to what we see today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Judy in Hearst on the phone. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I am really enjoying today's topic, by the way.
Good.
My question is, are current filmmakers influenced by some of these TV shows? And I don't mean by making a movie about Fat Albert or Car 54, Where Are You? But I mean influenced. And what made me think of it was last year's Sherlock Holmes, which to me seemed a lot like the TV show The Wild Wild West, more so than the movie a few years ago with Will Smith, which I thought was awful.
That's an interesting question.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thanks for your call. What do you think, Mike?
Well, first of all, I will tell you that we interviewed Robert Conrad of The Wild Wild West, and he would completely agree that the movie based on his TV show was awful. he never misses an opportunity to say that. And, you know, watching The Wild Wild West was quite a treat because it was a very different kind of a show than anything else that was on at that time, much more James Bondian. I think to answer the caller's question, I mean, I think everybody influences everybody else. I mean, everybody who works in TV watches TV, and if you see a good idea, you're going to use it. I mean, a good example would be a show like Mannix, which we all think of as kind of just a standard sort of crime drama, but it was produced by a guy named Bruce Geller, who was really the first to sort of cut shows very much more rapidly and sort of almost the style we see today where, you know, before Mannix, you know, you'd drive up and you'd get out of the car and you'd go in the building and you'd push the elevator button. Well, he just cut out all that and just got to the scenes where stuff actually happened. And that faster pacing now is something that, you know, everybody uses when they produce a television show.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable to go back and watch some of these old classics that you remember watching as a kid or as a younger adult. And it's striking how much more slowly they move.
It's a real challenge. And I think it's part of the challenge that you know, we faced in producing the series is, you know, our expectations as an audience have changed. I mean, you can't help it. I mean, you just expect shows that are faster and you know, even things like fist fights. You know, every show back in the 50s, that was the definition of excitement, was you'd have, you know, two guys fight. And it's funny because nowadays if you shoot a fist fight, there's lots of close-ups and lots of, you know, slow motion and sweat flies and all this kind of stuff. And back then they just kind of have one shot of guys fighting, you know. And we're just not used to seeing it that way, you know.
Yeah, it's a funny story. We had Robert Duvall on this show last year, and to prepare, I knew a lot of his better-known work, so I went and found an old episode of The Twilight Zone that he was in, where he plays this guy who's trapped in a dollhouse, and it's this very strange story. But, you know, he's this extraordinary actor, and it's this extraordinary, groundbreaking show, but it was a little hard to watch because it takes forever and things happen almost in real time.
You know, it's interesting. I think that it's the kind of thing that if you immerse yourself in it, you can sort of adjust. It's kind of like if we all turned off our email and our iPads and everything and our Blackberries for the first day, it'd be hard to adjust. But after a week or two, we'd be fine. And it's sort of the same way with old TV. I noticed that at first I thought every show is really boring. But, you know, after watching for a while, you kind of get in the rhythm and you realize what people were up to back then.
How much TV did you have to watch, Mike, to put this all together?
Well, I was lucky. I grew up in a My mother grew up in Chicago, and we moved to a rural part of Wisconsin, and she didn't like the quiet. So she turned the TV on in 1965 and never turned it off. So, so I saw everything as a kid, and that really helped me in the production of this series, because a lot of the shows are already familiar to me. But, yeah, I did have to plow through a lot of old shows. And you know, it's the kind of thing in any medium, you know, there's good and there's bad. I mean, there's great books in your bookstore, but there's a lot of crummy books in your bookstore, and there's great radio, and then there's poor radio, and I think the same is true of television. And I had, I did that for your audience. I sifted through it. I give you the good stuff.
Yeah, our program director here at the TV station says that he watches bad TV so that you don't have to. He selects the good stuff, and then you don't have to watch the other stuff.
Exactly, yes.
Let me ask you this. Was it hard to get the rights to any of the stuff you wanted to use?
Yeah, that is, that's why you don't see more shows like this, frankly. It's a real challenge, and it's more of a, it takes teams of lawyers, and in every shot you have to deal with, you know, who's in that shot, and is it in the public domain or is it not, and who owns it, and who says, and the bigger problem, not to bore your audience, but the bigger problem is there are lots of people running around Los Angeles who say they own things they don't really own. And so they'll call you up and demand money, even though they have absolutely no right to that money whatsoever. So that's another challenge you have to deal with. So it is, it's tricky. It is indeed.
So we should say that after the new episodes air, PBS is going back and re-airing the ones that you produced a couple years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Every station is doing a little bit differently, but the idea is, yeah, there'll be 7 or 8 weeks of Pioneers, 4 new episodes on Westerns. Of course, crime dramas, local kids TV, and the science fiction one that just ran. And then they'll be repeating, every station's different, but I think they'll be repeating the one on sitcoms, maybe the one on late-night television, and there was also one on variety shows.
Sitcoms are so much fun, and there are so many great stories that came out of that first episode that you did about that. I think details that people didn't just weren't aware of, like the Andy Griffith Show has this amazing backstory.
And which backstory are you referring to?
Well, the fact that, first of all, Andy Griffith was like a walk-on character, or he had a small part in another show. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually went down to North Carolina and interviewed him, and he's just kind of a fascinating character. Yeah, he had played this character and sort of the Southern good old boy character, and it went, he was on multiple different talk shows and variety shows, and he would do these comedy routines. They were basically kind of long stories, and they were so popular that he became really popular, and so actually, by the time he started the television series, he was actually a well-established star in kind of his later years, although he went on to much longer after that. But, yeah, he's a kind of a fascinating character. And really, like a lot of television stars, what you see is kind of what you get. I mean, when we interviewed James Garner, for example, who grew up in Oklahoma, not too far from you guys there, and, you know, they're just pretty much how they are. I mean, they're not putting on an act for television. I think the idea of television is, like I was saying earlier, it's transparent. You can tell if somebody's sort of being themselves. And Andy Griffith is an example of that. And almost everyone we interviewed, if they succeeded on television, they're pretty much in real life how you see them on TV.
Well, we look forward to watching the new episodes and then seeing once again perhaps the older episodes. It's been such a pleasure to have you on, Mike Trinkline.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Mike Trinkline is producer of the PBS series Pioneers of Television. It's running Tuesday nights at 7 on KERA Channel 13 Television. I am joined now by Jeff Whittington, who is senior producer of Think and host of Everything You Ever Wanted to Know, and has a variety of other job descriptions that we won't go into now because we would use up the entire fundraising break. But it's good to have you here, and it's kind of exciting to be in the fundraising campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's our chance to really talk to you, the people who listen every day, and ask you to support the station. I mean, that's what we do. We make shows, we make programming, we go out and get the news and bring it to you and broadcast it, and you can listen to it absolutely for free wherever you are at any time. And especially with the new iPhone app and the Droid app is on its way, Droid folks, I promise. We're being told every day it's on its way soon. And, you know, you can even rewind live radio and listen anywhere in the world to your favorite public radio station. All we ask that you do in return is at least once a year. Trust me, if you want to do it more than once a year, that'd be great too. But at least once a year, call the station at 888-694-6931. Or even better, go online to KERA.org and make a financial contribution at whatever level is right for you. And actually using the web Using the web to make your contribution is a lot cheaper for the station just because of data entry and things like that. It's actually much more efficient if you go online, if you can, and make your contribution there.
That is KERA.org. If you do prefer to make a telephone call, we are happy to take
that
as well. 1-888-694-6931. Thank you to Leah Redler in Dallas, Janine Kelly, and Christopher Stewart in Fort Worth for your contributions. We are waiting to hear from you next. The truth is, Jeff, you said we can listen for free. This station is freely available, but it's not free to produce the content. It's not free to broadcast it out to North Texas. It's not free to put the content up on the web and in all these other emerging digital media. We are so privileged and happy to be able to do that for you, but we count on your sponsorship of this show. Instead of looking to commercial sponsors, we look to you, our listeners, to sponsor the show. Quite frankly, to guide the kind of programming we choose. We don't have to find out what, you know, an automaker wants us to do. We go to you because your contributions make up the bulk of our support.
That's absolutely right. And you think about what it takes just to give you the Think broadcast. You know, we have to have a studio. We have to have computers. We have to have microphones and headphones. And we have to have everything that puts the spoken voice or a telephone guest, like we just had Mike Trinkline, on the radio and makes it sound good. And so that's got to be beamed out to Cedar Hill via, I believe, microwave transmission. And then it's broadcast from the tower out there. So that takes a lot. There's a lot of infrastructure there just to bring you this one show. And that has quite an astounding, probably, cost to do, even on a daily basis, just to maintain and provide the electricity for that. But then if you look at the podcast or the app, we have to have someone develop the website where we can host the podcast. We have to have another computer where we can edit the audio and put it up online. We have to pay for that internet connection that's fast enough to put up a super huge file like we put up every single day of each hour of Think. And then to develop an app so that you can listen to it on your iPhone, that has a cost associated with it too.
And the reality is those of us on the staff are constantly thinking up new ways to serve you and new kinds of programming that we can give you and new delivery platforms. And the folks who are in charge of the money are delighted about that, but they also say, hey, we've got to have the resources to do this. If you want to continue providing this to the audience, then make sure that the money is there. And we are so grateful that we can turn to you and ask you very honestly, please send a few dollars our way every month, every year. Your contribution makes a big difference. Please go online now to KERA.org and make a pledge. It used to be a pledge. Now it's pretty much a make a contribution because it happens pretty automatically for most of you who use credit and debit cards.
Yeah, pledge language is still ingrained in our brains.
I know.
But really, we just want you to go online, and it's a very simple, safe, secure transaction. You use your credit card if you'd like. You can ask for an invoice, and that's a pledge because you're pledging to send in your check when we send you the bill, which we're happy to do. But yeah, you can just make a contribution right away online, and it goes to work right away here at the station, and it helps us meet our revenue goals, which aren't arbitrary. I mean, we've got to raise the money to keep the station on the air, to continue to bring you the programs that you want to hear. It's really simple. It's very, very simple. We want to increase our audience, of course, so that more people hear what we believe is essential and quality programming. But at the same time, we also have to raise more money as our audience grows, because that's how NPR dues work.
1-888-694-6931 is the phone number. Best way to make a pledge is online at KERA.org. You can check out thank you gifts there. If there's something that you're interested in, that you've heard about, that you thought, I was going to make a contribution, but I wanted to wait until they talked about such and such. A lot of those things are still available, and if you zip around on the website, you can find them. And by all means, don't wait for us to mention it again. You can probably get it. And if you have questions, call that number, 888-694-6931, and ask the folks on the phone.
When you make that call, when you make that contribution, you can let us know why you're contributing on the web form at KERA.org. There's a place where you can put comments in, and we'd love to see and hear from you why. And you know what? I always say this during a drive, and I'm going to continue to say it because I'm going to say it right now. I'd also like to know why you won't support the station, because if there's a reason that you're not supporting the station, then darn it, I could try to figure out why, or maybe even help you with that issue. You can email me directly at jwhittington@kera.org, jwhittington@kera.org, and I'd love to know why we can't convince you to make your contribution during this drive, because it really is your public radio station, and obviously you listen to the station and you use the station, so we hope that you would take responsibility for your portion, just 1/400,000th of what it takes to run this radio station.
Jeff's parents and my parents cannot do it alone.
That's right.
They're retired.
Somehow they managed to download the Think podcast 82,000 times last month, but they can't support the whole station.
We'd love to hear from you right now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Make a contribution in any amount you want. If you want to set up a sustaining membership, maybe you could do $20 or even $50 a month pretty comfortably for your budget. We would love to hear from you right now. Again, go online to kera.org or pick up that phone and call 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.